Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello, and welcome back to the Who's On Worst podcast. We've been away a while, but we haven't forgotten you, and we have not stopped watching terrible, terrible baseball movies. So as that is our gift to you on a regular basis, we have returned triumphant just as the season begins to wind down, and we will be talking to you this week about Angels in the Outfield. We have obviously previously discussed some classic children's fare, such as Air Bud, Seventh Inning Fetch, and Rookie of the Year. But as always, I am joined by my co-host, Darby Robinson, and our wonderful producer, Brett Rutherford. So Darby, why don't you tell us a little bit about Angels in the Outfield?
Thank you, Ashley. Yeah, Angels in the Outfield, and we're to clarify, this is not the 1950s kind of black and white musical comedy. This is the Disney-fied 1990s. Children's shenanigan film? I don't know.
It's not a feel-good film.
It is darker than I remembered. It's not particularly funny. I mean, maybe for like little kids. It's more of like a weird dramedy, like very sappy over the, there's a lot. And we'll get into that because there's obviously a huge amount of religious allegories. There's a lot of like really big melodrama. But as we're going to start it off, like we always do, let's do the quick Rotten Tomatoes synopsis for this film. Foster kid Roger, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, loves the Anaheim Angels, even though they're the worst team in the major leagues. His estranged dad promises to reunite the family if the Angels make it to the World Series, so Roger decides to ask for some divine help and prays that his favorite team will turn things around. Soon, a real angel named Al, played by Christopher Lloyd, shows up in response to Roger's prayers, and Anaheim's hopeless coach, Danny Glover, is shocked to see his team on a winning streak. Angels in the Outfield.
That does sum it up. Yeah. I would like to point out quickly, though, that this movie features an absolute bombardment of, hey, this guy's in that movie. We got Dermot Mulroney playing Roger's dad. Obviously, Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Roger in a before he was a star kind of move. This was before Third Rock from the Sun, which I think was his really big break. So this was kind of the beginning of the Joseph Gordon-Levitt legacy. Matthew McConaughey is one of the titular angels in the outfield, not to be mistaken for one of the actual angels, but he is one of the players. Adrian Brody.
We have multiple Oscar winners and nominees.
Kicking around. Danny Glover, obviously. But yeah, it's wild how many famous people are in this movie as a like before they were stars kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a power-packed cast, a shockingly power-packed cast. And the director, William Dear, he had some pretty strong kids movie fare. He did Harry and the Hendersons and The Rocketeer, which is one of my favorite kids movies. Also a Disney kind of class. I don't know if it's a class. It kind of became a cult classic. Not really so much. Didn't really do, I think, super well for them. But he was, kind of a proven, good, steady hand there. So all the pieces were in place for, I think, a pretty strong movie. And the concept itself, I think, is somewhat kind of interesting, right? Like some sort of weird magical thing that helps this hapless team succeed. But overall, it's a very weird movie. I just don't know. I didn't really get a lot from this movie. Like I didn't feel a lot. And I don't know. It just, it, whatever they were trying to do just didn't land with me personally.
No, it feels like it's supposed to be a lesson movie. Like it feels like there's supposed to be some sort of broad strokes, life learned sort of situation that we're supposed to take away from this with, like, especially I think, and spoiler alert, if you don't want to be spoiled to the ending of a movie that was released in 1994, why are you listening to our podcast? Obviously, it comes down to it at the end where Al tells Roger that the Angels can only help in the regular season, but to postseason play is out. God has no hand when it comes to helping the postseason.
The rules, the rules are so nebulous with these Angels. They really are picking and choosing.
Very real if you've ever watched baseball as a fan, because the gods do not care how you feel in the postseason. But yeah, that's the big thing, right? And I guess when they do the, you know, there's an angel with you right now, and the whole stadium gets up, and it's meant to be this, you know, the power was in you all along sort of thing. But it's very heavy-handed. Like, I think it's meant to be sweet, but they really lay it on thick. I think especially when right before that, Al tells Roger that Tony Danza is going to die in like 6 months.
That came out of nowhere. They drop that right on, like the drama was high enough. Like, we have our stakes, right? They're just like talking about how like the Angels are hanging around. So Tony Danza also in this movie playing Mel Clark, who's this aging, very battered, you know, pitcher who's like just kind of give it one last go. We, you know, if we're really comparing, you know, children's movies, Rookie of the Year has the same thing where you have this older, gruff, you know, the Rocket type of guy who's just trying to get one last, you know, kind of go around, you know, leave it all on the mound. But yeah, they're just basically talking about how the Angels sort of show up to scout him because he's got some sort of terminal disease.
It's just like lung cancer or something, because he coughed a lot.
Oh yeah, it's true. Something. Yeah, he did. Know. No, it's honestly nothing. No movies work well right now with like coughing as like a sign of some sort of hidden illness. It's not they didn't know what they were doing in 94, but it's like, ugh, I don't love it. Yeah, he's got a terminal illness, probably cancer. He's about to die. And the Angels know that he will die in 6 months. So they know the deaths. They know when everybody's death time is. And they're basically like scouting him out to become another angel, like a sport angel. It's weird. And it's just like, wow, holy crap. Like, what a heavy, like, this is a children's movie.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It is a lot to just throw out there. And I don't think you need to. You could sort of say, like, they're sort of scouting for, like, his, like, eventual, you know.
Just time don't say doesn't it matter at all. Just say,
Angels, but
we can't participate postseason. You know, it's got to be up to you guys. End of story. This movie was so laden with tragedy. It was unreal. Like, you got your central kids or two foster kids. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I think, and I don't remember 100%, but I think Roger's mom had died. And obviously his dad was kind of a useless.
Yeah. You know, Dermot Mulroney doesn't have a lot of scenes in this movie, but like every scene he's in
is he's the worst.
Like, what an absolute piece of shit.
The Rotten Tomatoes write-up gives the indication that he's like, yeah, son, if the Angels win, we'll be a family again. But that's not it. It's like very dismissive. It's like, hey, Dad, when are we going to be a family again? He's like, you know, when pigs fly. Like, it's not meant to be. But as a kid, you're like, oh, okay, well, this is the one thing that can do it. So let's go.
Because his two scenes are him basically being like, I'm going to ride my motorcycle and take off. It's like, when are we going to be a family? Like, I don't know, when the Angels win the pennant. Sure, whatever. And like, that's his like, you know, flipping thing. And he rides off. And then the next time you see him is at like the court hearing where he's basically like, I give up. I renounce all rights. This kid is nothing to me. And then doesn't even speak with him. Just walks right past. It's like brutal. Dermot Mulroney. Horrible.
The other little kid, like, what's his buddy's name? Like, I want to say JP, but it's like, what is his friend's name?
It's JP.
Is it really? Did I actually remember that?
Got JP, yeah.
Wow. I mean, I realize it's two letters and like, I should not pat myself on the back for this, but I just called this I called him Ralph 3 seconds ago. So
are we letting our listeners in on the secret that we watched this movie months ago and we're now just recording?
Well, so anybody who knows the last episode we released was The Fan. And I think that's been three months since that came out. And initially, our intention had been to do a double feature, like a double header recording session of Angels in the Outfield and The Fan. And you're welcome. You recorded The Fan and we had the wonderful little cameo podcast insert there. And It was a ton of fun. But we have not watched Angels in the Outfield since June. Sounds about right.
There was a big issue with this movie of finding it at the time, which was really strange because I was like, okay, well, do a movie because we've been picking these movies and a lot of them are really obscure and hated movies, so they like aren't available everywhere, like nobody's buying the rights for them to show them, except for Showtime, it seems, with a lot of these movies. So I don't know what Showtime's buying them in the bargain bin. But this movie, I was like, oh, it's a Disney movie. Obviously, it'll be great. When the time we tried to watch this, we could not find this anywhere. Like, I scoured the internet. I looked at every streaming site, there was no rental available. There was no streaming available. I checked sites of less than on front origin.
Of ill repute.
Nothing there.
I don't think the feds are going to be knocking on your doors, Darby, anytime soon.
I couldn't even if I wanted to. It was crazy. I was like, you could not watch this movie anywhere. It was remarkable. I was like, how is this scrubbed from existence? And then eventually we did find, somebody had uploaded it to YouTube and I was able to watch it via that way. But then in the couple of days before for you guys watch it, then disappeared from there. So I think, Ashley, you got it from like the library.
I took it out of the library. Yeah. It's, I forwarded it from the Winnipeg Public Library. Yeah.
Shout out to the Winnipeg Public Library.
Shout out WPL for making this podcast possible.
Good job.
Yeah.
I think Turner had the cable rights for it at the time. So I was able to watch it on the TNT app with ads. We all got to watch it just in very, very peculiar ways.
By far the hardest movie we've had to, like, most of these, you know, it's just like you rent it, it's right there, boom, you know, whatever. Amazon's got everything. Yeah. You can just rent it like $2 and you're in. But like this movie, for some reason, totally scrubbed from the internet. It was a strange one, right? So it's...
I was just going to say about JP, because we were talking about tragedy, right? That JP, the backstory they give him is that him and his mom were like living in the front seat of her car. And like, I think it was heavily indicated that she had a bit of a drug problem. Like it's dark. You did not need to add Tony Danza has cancer and is going to die in 6 months. This movie had enough hardship going for it. Like,
it's a rough one. It's got the... Speaking of like other like talent, the foster mom of the two is from other classic kids movies, Home Alone 2, the pigeon lady. She appears there. Fantastic job in both as like a very warm and nurturing and kind of positive light in a deeply depressing and sad children's movie.
It was one of the few notes I made that wasn't just like a joke about something when I made notes on this, is that she was just a genuinely lovely foster mom. Like, they could have easily turned that on its head and been like, oh, foster mom has change of heart, decides to keep the kids. Mm-hmm. Or they could have done the really cliched thing and made her super awful. Like, she was only in it to like, you know, rake in the government checks and didn't care about the kids. But it was very apparent that she like really did care about each of the kids under her care and wanted to make sure that they found families and really, I think, tried to help them understand very difficult things that were happening. Like, she was there for Roger when his dad gave up all the rights and she was the one giving him hugs at the end. And I think that particular role was beautifully handled because I think it did give a glimpse into what good foster parents are. And that's not necessarily a rare thing, but it's a rare thing in media. Mm-hmm. And it was a nice change of pace to see that.
I think the individual actors in this movie did a pretty good job. I think there's definitely some standouts. Obviously, Joseph Gordon-Levitt was a tremendously talented, like, kids actor. Like, he is incredible. And there's a reason. I mean, like, he got his start as a kid actor, and that's, like, where, you know, most of America fell in love with him. And he's been, a tremendously successful actor ever since. He's, like, you can tell, like, this is a star. Like, this is an absolute star. He is crushing it at a very young age. What I was really surprised by was looking in to his friend, JP, played by Milton Davis Jr. He never really did anything after this. He
was,
like,
great
did not
in this. Act.
He was sensational. JP was,
he was
the cutest.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Every scene, JP is adorable.
He steals it. And that's the thing. I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt's performance in this is very earnest. Like, it's earnest, and it's aching, and he wants to prove things to people, and he wants to help, and he wants all of that. Where JP is just this, like, precocious, scene-stealing, charming entity. Like, I think one of my first notes on this was like, oh, my God, this other kid is adorable.
So, and then
you get to the end, again, spoilers, Danny Glover's manager character comes to adopt Roger and is like, hey, well, I'm going to take you on full time, and we're going to maybe try to make a family. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, you do not take this other kid, I'm going to climb into that TV and punch you in the face. You cannot do this to me. Like, I've
you're,
seen
you're
it
gonna
before.
You're going to send a letter to present day Danny Glover to be like, yeah, how dare you, first of
be
all.
Like, damn it, Danny. What the hell? You can't leave this adorable little kid behind. Because I'm sitting there and I'm like, no recollection of watching it as a kid. And I'm like, this is the greatest outrage in the history of cinema. And then, of course, it's just like, okay, psych. But wow, what a mean thing to do to JP, because it was really built up in that scene. Like, hey, Roger's going home. Roger's got a family. And you see this poor kid sitting there going, well, I've been to all of the games. I have also bonded with this man. What am I, like, chopped liver? And I'm like, oh, you monsters. And then obviously it's like, oh, of course JP can come. And I'm like, I feel like that's not how adoptions work, but okay. like it's not like it's not like going to, like, the Humane Society and being like, oh, look, these kittens are a bonded pair, I will take both of them.
You get both. Yeah,
like,
JP,
I feel like
likes
can.
Nachos and Coke.
Yeah.
Doesn't like anyway. Keeping control of them.
Oh, God, that poor assistant, or what was
yeah, like, Taylor Negron, his whole role is basically just getting spilled on by, yeah, by
JP. Like the team's PR agent or something. Mm-hmm. I think that was mm-hmm. his
quick side note on Taylor Negron, who the late mm-hmm. Taylor Negron, who passed a few years ago. I think one of the reasons is a lot of these movies, these older movies, like the biggest example was Rookie of the Year. We actually did think it was a fine movie. It's not the best movie ever, but for me, it packed, like, that nostalgic punch. I watched it a ton as a kid. I didn't watch Angels in the Outfield maybe more than once or twice as a kid, and I think maybe one of the, like, subconscious reasons is Taylor Negron, again, no disrespect to the late Taylor Negron, his face kind of creeps me out. And his face and his long hair, he could very easily, and maybe he has in his filmography, played some villainous characters in children's movies, but for some reason, I don't know, I definitely as a kid, his face would have creeped me out.
He's got that character actor face, like, what, because I never knew his name, mm-hmm. but he's 100% one of those guys where you see him and he's like, oh, that guy, like, he's the absolute yeah. classic character actor. And, like, I'm looking through his
he was in, like, a million
credits
things. Absolutely,
he's been
a million
in
things.
So much stuff, and he's got, like, you definitely recognize him. He was in, like, a Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen TV show, the So Little Time series.
Yeah. He does a great job as, like, you know, the full comedic relief. And like we said, like, all the side characters do a really interesting job. One of the things that I, similar to Brett, I did not watch this movie a ton as a kid. I think I watched it, like, once. And I just didn't like it, I think, as a kid. I watched Rookie of the Year, like, constantly as a kid. So this one was definitely did not have those, like, nostalgic feels. So I think that definitely hurts it, because, you know, watching it now as a grown adult, it's, like, pretty schmaltzy in a lot of ways. I was kind of surprised that there's no, like, you have a lot of really interesting side characters, right? I mean, like, we mentioned, like, there's, you know, you have, like, Neil McDonough, Adrian Brody, Matthew McConaughey, Tony Danza as the players in there. And they, you know, aside from Tony Danza, they don't really get much to, you know, do. You have Adrian Brody has like a couple of lines. Matthew McConaughey has like a line. Neil McDonough
just gets to look bewildered a lot.
Goofy stuff.
Matthew McConaughey's whole role is to just look bewildered by things.
Yeah. Neil McDonough has at least some, he has some definitely quirky, he's playing kind of like the Brickma type of like quirky pitcher. But you know, it's, I was kind of surprised that we don't really get a lot of like, I think a film like this really does rely, would benefit strongly from getting to know like the team a little bit better,
yeah,
or getting to know the Angels a bit better, like the actual, like,
as opposed to just
supernatural beings.
Yeah, they really are just like they float in on the screen and then they leave.
They have no character or role. And
so
at the end of the movie, when we are told that Tony Danza, Mel Clark, is about to die and he's going to become one of these angels, that would have been a cool thing if you set it up where each of these angels was like an old player or something. You know, you'd have like your Shoeless Joe Jackson or your, you know, like, you know, actually have these characters who like, you could have all make-believe, you know, baseball players, but you'd have these like old baseball players that still get to, you know, enjoy the game.
Yeah,
because this is what they do, and they help people who like deserve that help. I think for me, the biggest problem is the character. There's no characters there, and there's no. I really wanted to set up some rules because it just feels like Al, the head angel by Christopher Lloyd, is just like he's just making stuff up as he's going along. He's just like, yeah, we can help now. Now we can't help because of this rule, and it's just like I need like a three simple rules at the beginning so I can set up and know like what I'm expecting. And I just think it was kind of like fell flat. Now, everything with Christopher Lloyd is tremendous. I mean, Christopher Lloyd, again, charisma through the roof, does a fantastic job. Him and Joseph Gordon-Levitt, because that's the only character that he interacts with.
Yeah.
Fantastic chemistry. Like, that all works. I just would have liked to see maybe a little bit more of that or more characterization in the film.
Him stealing the American League umpire's cap. To be like, I'm Al. That was a great moment. Very kind of charming nod to a real thing, obviously, which I quite liked. But yeah, it's, you're right, because the only character we're really given any depth with on the team is Danny Glover's manager character. And he's a dick. Like, he is terrible for about 75% of the movie. Like, he'll slowly kind of grudgingly accept Roger's input. And he obviously like brings him to games and listens to him, but there's nothing altruistic about that. He wants to win games and he thinks this kid can give him some kind of inside track on that. And then slowly, obviously learns to develop. But like when they have the photo shoot at the beginning, he thinks the kid's mentally unstable. And he's like, get this kid out of here. Yeah. Like he's gruff and he's mean to his players and he's not a likable guy.
Terrible manager. Also,
yeah.
From what everything we've seen, absolutely a terrible manager.
Yeah, like coming out mid at bat to like, you know, and his players don't seem to understand that when a manager takes the field that they're going to be done for the day. Like there's some really goofy baseball anachronisms in here that show that either the screenwriters didn't understand how management works or the manager in the game didn't understand how baseball works.
It's really weird. Him and Tony Danza too have this like weird relationship where it's like he like is actively bullying like Mel Clark, and it's like this weird like vendetta where he's like I'm healthy. He's just like, you know, you're a real piece of crap, Mel. I'll never pitch you. You suck. You're washed out. It's just like, what is happening?
You could be the last pitcher on earth and I'd never let you start a game. Like,
this is some toxic locker room. Like, this is their problem right here. And it's very odd. Like, I think, Danny Glover does a good job with that, but it's like a very strange character.
And he's very much Danny Glover. Like, Danny Glover is one of those actors, I think, that has a really hard time being a character as opposed to being the actor. You know, there's guys like that. Like, Will Smith, I'm never going to believe him absorbing into a role. He's always going to be Will Smith. Ryan Reynolds, same idea. Like, he's never going to be anything other than Ryan Reynolds. And I think Danny Glover very frequently is that kind of actor where it's like, he's Danny Glover. So at that same time, when the character's being a dick, it's really hard for you to commit to buying him as a dick because he's Danny Glover, right? So mm-hmm. you know, just because of the sheer presence of someone as likable as that, that by the end of this movie, you're going to like his character because right. that's just, you can't, I think maybe once, I don't know. And I feel like I'm making this up just for the sake of argument. He might've played like a killer in a movie and I was like, whoa, what happened there? But like, it's, I don't think you could put him in a movie and have people buy him as a villain.
No. My biggest struggle with this movie is that it is just a very strange and nebulous plot, not plot, but like theme. Or like there is a lesson you mentioned, right? That's like the whole lesson of like believing yourself, I think, is what it's going on. Because, you know, at the end, you know, Mel Clark is like gutting out a really tough, you know, performance.
156 pitches.
Terrible managing. Again, terrible managing. He's blowing his arm out. I like kept track. They like literally mentioned how like Mel Clark is tiring like six times or eight yeah. times like throughout the thing. And it's like he's been like tiring since the fourth. Like for
Christ's sake, he's been retiring off. Since like 4 years previous in his career, if we're
crazy.
Being honest.
But like he's up, he's like gutting it out. And the whole like, you know, kind of ending thing is that, you know, he has now an angel with him is cool, kind of the little lie to kind of say like to do it, but he actually doesn't. It's all him. He does that himself. And that gives him the power to believe. But I don't know if that's really like that's a moral of the movie, but it's a very like that's not the thing. I guess the whole thing is like getting the team to play together and commit together, but that's also super nebulous. I wish there was more of like a real, like, I think the ending with the, like creating a family and like yeah. striving for family is that makes a lot of sense. So I think if you could have made it more like that, where like the team starts very much at odds with each other, everybody hates each other. And the angels kind of help to bring the, like the good spirit of like you're winning, but you're also now getting to know each other and bond yeah. with each other. That could have maybe like tied into that final theme of finding like your family. Your family is who you find.
It's a really wonderful trope. Like you see it a lot in fiction and it is a very popular trope. The idea of like family is what you discover. And I think we could have probably seen them take a track like we saw with Rookie of the Year, where maybe there was like, you know, a team owner and he was kind of thinking of passing it on to his son, but he doesn't think his son really loves baseball. And they like really come together and bond over this team coming together and winning. Like there's a lot of ways I think you could have layered that, like have the team start to trust and rely on each other and have these kids kind of bond together and bond with the manager and really like tie that all nicely. And that was why Al was there, and that's why, you know, the angels were there instead of just like, when you think about it, what was the point of having them win the pennant if they didn't actually answer the core root of the prayer? Like, yes,
it doesn't.
When we're going to be a family again, again, he is in a family at the end, I get it. Mm-hmm. But it's not, you know, it's not quite.
It doesn't cleanly land. And that's why I think there's like this kind of empty feeling there, which is why are the angels there? It doesn't really kind of come in. And the team does eventually, you know, have this scene. So the main antagonist of the movie, the main like kind of crux against the movie, besides Dermot Mulroney just being a jerk, there's this, basically the villain of the movie is Michael Kay. Of the Yes Network, because it's a very weird, like he is the announcer for the team and like a like journalist / radio host elsewhere. So like similar to, not to say Michael Kay is a villain, I'm saying like that character where it's like you both work for the team, but then also for like local like New York radio. This character is sort of a Ranch Wilder, great broadcast name. He is both the team's like radio broadcaster, TV broadcaster, as well as like a journalist. He is kind of the main antagonist. He's like a real jerk, blowhard, and he doesn't like Danny Glover's character, George Knox. He is actively trying to sabotage him. And the eventually what he, how he like kind of the main like kind of problem is that he finds out from the kids that like they are seeing real angels and that George Knox believes in that. And that's why the angels are winning. And then that means that then the owner gets upset and he's going to fire him. And then he has to have a press conference where he denounces that. All of this, though, I have to say, is one of the stupidest plot points. Like, I know it's a kid's movie, but this is one of the stupidest plot points I've ever seen. Like, why would anybody believe this, this absolutely stupid idea? Like, why would this announcer be like, the kids say that there's physical, real, supernatural beings helping this baseball team win? And this manager, you have to deny it. It's like, who cares? What is happening? Why is anybody believing this? There's two foster kids believing this. What is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? Who is doing
this? Let's take a quick break and let's get back into that point and the discussion of that press conference when we get back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So, as Darby pointed out before we took a break, yeah, there's this kind of ridiculous subplot. And I made a note on this saying that if I had only watched this movie, I would never in a million years want to become a baseball reporter. Because, wow, like, if this is like shaping your future and your decision making as a child, I would definitely not be where I am today. But yeah, so there is like this weird subplot of this overheard suggestion that it's real angels and that's doing the thing. I want you to imagine for one moment reading something from like Mark Topkin
Jeff Passan breaking a tweet.
Ken Rosenthal on The Athletic is giving us insight into a baseball manager who believes in angels. And I grant you, there was a Britt Giroli article last week about how deep breathing has changed the entire Red Sox outlook on baseball on The Athletic. So, like, strange things have occurred in baseball writing.
It's a long season.
I grant you, we need to come up with article ideas somewhere. But like, if you were to read from a serious baseball beat writer slash, you know, primary voice of the team, something as truly absurd as what this guy goes out there, writes an article on, it would not be the manager or the children being laughed at because of that article.
100%. 100%. Like, I have these notes. Why is anybody believing this absurd story? Why would they believe the radio guy? Why would they need to fire the manager? Why would they believe a strange child claiming to see angels? Like, what in the world is going on here? Why would anybody believe any of this?
Well, and even if they did, it's not like he believes that demons are helping. Like, in a fundamental, and I say this as a pagan, but like, this is a very largely Christian society, right? So yeah, for anybody to come out and say, you know, like, I believe that angels, like, this is a team where everybody hitting home plate after a home run grabs the cross around their neck, kisses their fingers, and looks to Jesus as a thank you for that home run. And we're supposed to believe that anybody would have a fundamental issue with, angels, I believe in those. Okay, cool. I mean, are they winning games? Is the team going to go to the World Series? Awesome. Who cares what you believe
in? I mean, like, faith is a big part of sports. I mean, like, that's a huge part of sports. Like, people express their faith in a lot of different ways. People have all sorts. Like, it's absurd that, like, you would basically, I feel like this radio broadcaster slash reporter would be, like, in a lot of trouble for pretty discriminatory and weirdly bigoted, like, anti-faith, like it's a very strangely, like, take, right? Like, okay, you can question maybe the sanity of the manager, but, like, all he heard was a story where the kids were saying that they see real physical angels, right? And then that's helping them win. And the manager looks to the other kid to see like when there's angels like physically there. It's like such a straight, like you would read it and be like, oh, so, you know, George Knox is like, he is finding his inner peace through his like Christian faith. That's what I would be like. This is a weird thing that he's like going off of, but okay, that's maybe helping him be a better manager because he's calmed down. Whatever physical or non-physical manifestation, whatever faith versus non-thing, it's just the same. Like it doesn't, it's not weird. It's not even that weird. Like it's a really, 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 really strange plot point that is the entire like anti thing. Like that's the entire like obstacle to get over.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about a sport where in one season, the Mets used to hand around a giant dildo to different players every single game. Like you could tell me a manager had crystals in his office that he like charged via moonlight on games after his team won by a large margin, hoping that those crystals would help bring positive energy to his team. And I'd be like, rad.
Jason Giambi cool. wearing
that was a like thong. A Gabe Kapler thing. Like it's like
Jason Giambi wore a thong as like a good luck charm for like a hot streak when he was at the like, Oakland
that's
A's.
That's what kills me about this particular plot, because what sport ever is more superstitious than baseball? Like
it's like the opposite of in Major League with like, you know, Jobu and like the whole idea of like he is tapping in like every at bat he's talking to his, you know, preferred deity to like appease like that. And it makes in that movie, you're like, makes sense. Let's try to do whatever we can for Jobu to like to help our bats. And it's like that baseball embraces this.
Tell me in honesty, and we are all very big committed baseball fans here. If something came out that a manager believed angels were responsible for helping the team win, and the team was in fact winning and on their way to the postseason, tell me what baseball team on this planet would not start selling plushed angels, doing an angel wing giveaway at the gate, doing like halos out to everybody when they're coming in, first 10,000 guests get a light up halo, let's go. Like baseball embraces the stupid and the absurd in ways that no other sport does. Like we're talking about a team where Topps has a rally squirrel card and the Angels have the rally monkey in real life.
Exactly.
Like you cannot tell me that a team would be like, oh, this manager has got to go. They would be like, how do we make money on this? RotoWare and Breaking Tea would be busting out fresh merch. Like it's not realistic to believe that this is the path this would take, because baseball loves the stupid and the inane way too much to not just grab this.
Like Brett said, it's a long season. Like you need stuff. You need some weird, quirky stuff. So back into the movie, this story. This story basically means that now George Knox, Danny Glover, is in the hot seat, and the owner of the Angels is hyper furious about this story. Why? I have no idea. And he's like, you have to basically like denounce this we're going to fire you basically. And then that leads to a big press conference
which, frankly, I found was a very emotional scene. Like this is one of the few points in this movie where I actually cried because it gets to the family thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. It gets to the family thing where all of his players stand up and it's like, I don't want to play for anybody, but you know, George Knox.
Yeah.
And like, this is this great moment. And I thought the speech, I don't have a lot of it written down, but like I thought actually Danny Glover, I mean, this is where you get to like let Danny Glover cook a little bit. You know, you have a really good actor. So it's like, here we need an emotional point. You've been kind of just like a one note, like angry man character, but like, let's let Danny Glover, you know, do some work. and let's get ISO ball on Danny Glover and let him go nuts. And he does a great job. And it talks about like how he actually balances a pretty cool thing. So like he hasn't physically seen any of these angels. He is entirely going off of what this small child has told him. But he knows that the team is winning and things are going well and whatever is working. And so he sort of talks about how like this, like his, this faith, like, I don't know what it is. I don't know exactly what's going on, but I just believe that, you know, we can use this, like this good feeling and this emotion and people like working together. And it's like this really like, oh, that makes total sense. And in that situation, you would be like, as like the owner, first of all, that's where you should have been at the beginning. But two, like the next scene is like you fire that person because you can't let that guy represent your team because he just like dragged this out. And it's a good scene. It's a really good scene. But it's such like a strange like thing to overcome because like everybody would be like, yeah, sure, whatever. I don't know. Everything's working. What is wrong? Like, I don't get it. I don't get why this is a challenge to overcome. But he does overcome it and they're, you know, everything's good.
Yeah. And it is, it's a good scene. Like it's aside from the absurdity of being in that particular position, which should never happen. And like the crux behind it is it does play well emotionally. And you're right. It is, it feels earned, even though I don't think they've given us enough backstory of any of those characters or the dynamic between them. But because there's stakes on the line and him losing his job and thusly the season being in peril because of it. And obviously we don't know it yet, but the risk of Roger and JP losing their new father as all part of that is that I think it does play to a point where it's like, okay, well, this feels meaningful. And it feels like something has happened in a positive way. And it is. It did make me cry. I was a little bit cheery. There was some mist.
Yeah, and yeah, it was solid. So, with that out of the way, comes to the next sort of thing, which is still like the on the field baseball. And so, you get all sorts of good slapstick baseball throughout the movie, with angels assisting things and weird craziness and quirky fun stuff that like starts like the winning streak. And overall, like this movie has some of the most aggressively 90s special effects you could imagine. Yes. Like, it is very like they were pulling out all of the tricks from the early like what Final Cut 2 like box. They were just like, bam, late like stars, like we're gonna make a shimmer, like, oh, here we go, like let's gonna do a chroma key and mat it over. And it's, they were everything. They were like, I got, look at all these things I can do. Let's do them all. But it's, which is very shocking. Again, this is a Disney property that had a pretty good amount of money behind it. And you're just like, look at that. And you're like, this is the same company that did like Fantasia like 30 years before this. How does this look so like cheesy and Air Bud-esque in some places? But, you know, I guess it doesn't look great in the 2021 viewing.
No, not through
maybe
the lens
it worked
of
better
current,
in the 90s.
Not through the lens of current media by any stretch. Yeah, it's rough. It's got those things, you know, people being blown back by pitches and it defies physics on every possible level and it doesn't even like look semi-realistic. But my favorite thing about it in retrospect, especially having rewatched it, is that when anything really ridiculous happens in real baseball now, I love being able to pull out this is some real angels in the outfield nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Fernando Tatis Jr. had a wonderful catch earlier this season where it looked like he double jumped. Mm-hmm. Like he just like got that extra leverage and I'm just like, oh, I see some wings. I know what's happening because that doesn't work. That's not how baseball functions. So
there's in the film, there's a catch from Matthew McConaughey's character where he like runs and he's not going to get it. And then the angel, like he like jumps.
Two of them, I think, pick him up and
they pick him up on the shoulder and they like carry him. And it's just like a nice little wire work, like carried like 50 yards away. And, yeah, it's like a very funny goofy thing. But then, you know, baseball does have some weird stuff, like you're like
it's, the thing. You like, know, you got so we have catch probability for a reason, right? So it's, you know.
Some of the things they help with, though, are like really funny because I mentioned, so you have Adrian Brody's character, Danny Hammerling, is this like tiny little like scrawny guy. Like they like help him out with like the bat. They're like helping bat for him. And like the best they got for him was like an infield single. Like they're like, we're going to use divine magic powers and we're going to give you like a squib hit. And there you go. Congratulations. Yeah. Yeah, that's your way to go. Matthew McConaughey is getting like thrown all over the field to catch balls, and he's to like Kiermaier out everywhere. And poor little Adrian Brody's like, here is a squib single for you. Enjoy.
Yeah. It's a little uneven. I think at one point they like, Al like changes where the foul pole is. Like,
yep.
Pulls the yeah. foul pole Carries back the foul to like, pole. Yeah. Cause I feel their, like you see that happen. I don't
their
know.
Their abilities are very overpowered. But like they don't always use it. My favorite though, Angel thing was the, umpire argument, the umpire manager argument, where again, very funny, physical, like nonverbal comedy, but with like, Christopher Lloyd, basically taking the angry umpire yeah. versus manager thing. And then changing it at the end of like, to a nice, like happy, like thank you for that great tough call. And I appreciate you. Have a great day, but like still with the angry intonations.
So that's based really in reality because, and I can't remember which manager it was, but I remember reading a story ages ago about a manager who came out to like get into the face of an umpire. And by the time he'd gotten to the umpire, he realized he was wrong. But he was already out there and he's like, look, and he's like all furious faced with the umpire. He's like, look, you made the right call, but I'm already out here. So I need you to play along with this nonsense. And the umpire's like, I understand. And if you just want to do this for a minute, we can. And they like, so I'll have to refine this story, but that is like 100% something that has absolutely happened in real life. And you just have to kind of save face and go out there and like, look good for the team. Like you're, you know, picking a fight. But yeah, that's I get a giggle out of that.
That's the little angels out there. That's Christopher Lloyd just changing things up.
And, just making turn that frown upside down.
Yeah. Yeah. I think overall the film, you know, the angels get you know, Mel Clark pitches a great game, he finishes it off. The angels are gonna go and win the pennant, and the kids get adopted and happily ever after in the end. It just like there's some scenes that work, you know. The ending is, you know, it's nice and emotional where they get adopted by Danny Glover. It's really sweet. And the press conference scene I thought really worked, but overall it's just it just feels like a little empty as a film.
Yeah.
And it's very strange because it is obviously about physical angels. So you're talking about something like things found in the Christian faith, but the movie is more like faith based than like Christian based, which I found kind of interesting. Like a lot of it is about like just spirituality in general.
Yeah.
And it just so happened with, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character, his spirituality is like, you know, Christian, but like there is a lot of just sort of talking about like believing in something bigger than yourself and believing in something that's more than what you can see. Which is an interesting topic if you explored it more, but they just sort of like kind of just dabble in it and then they kind of move on. So I think that could have been something more if you had a care, like if you made that like the central crux. I just think overall, I feel like the movie's a little light. It's a little like empty calories. And that's why I don't think this movie stands up very well in the pantheon of like kids movies. And it's really rare for like Disney to have such a like, and I think that's why like we couldn't find it anywhere, is because like Disney's like it's not even in the Disney vault. It's just sort of collecting dust somewhere, because so much of what makes a Disney movie great is that they have these locked in themes that they nail and they work. You know, they can be something like Snow White. It could be something like Cinderella, like that are decades old, or it can be something brand new with like Pixar, and they all work really well, whatever era because they resonate with kids, they resonate with adults, because they're just, yeah. they're great themes. They're fantastic storytelling, like simple but effective storytelling. And this film just, it just feels like there's maybe some cool ideas that they didn't have the courage to go with or just didn't fully flesh out. And it just, it falls really flat for me overall. It's not a bad movie. Like, I didn't hate watching this. I just didn't feel much watching this.
No. And it, for a movie that has such difficult topics, and like a difficult like core to it, you're right. It doesn't leave you feeling much, and it doesn't stick with you in like a memory kind of way. Like, you're not going to really sit there and think of anything from this movie that's not in the trailer. Like, the most important parts of this movie are 100% just the clips from the trailer. And once you've watched that, you're good. Like, you don't need more. And I think you're right. When you talk about the things that kind of stick out, like, I was thinking about movies I watched as a kid that still emotionally resonate with me. And the first thing that came to mind is not baseball related at all, but it's The Incredible Journey. And it's about like the pets that like make a cross country journey to get home to their friend, their families. Right. And I saw on TikTok the other day, cause TikTok loves to play with my emotions. It was like, what scene can make you cry in the span of about 30 seconds? And like, they showed the ending of one of those kids' movies about pets coming home from being lost in the wilderness. And it was like a dog limping, and I just like started bawling. And I'm like, there's nothing about this movie that would resonate with me that same way. Like, I don't think.
And with the heavy topics too, it seems like it's like a pretty much like a layup, but it.
Yeah. And it doesn't, I don't know that this movie really is for kids. And that's the thing. Like, there's nothing in it that's like, aside from, you know, JP always spilling his food on the PR guy's lap. And aside from that, and like maybe some sight gags with the baseball, there's nothing about it that really feels oriented to the audience that it was meant to be for. Like, yeah. It's mostly built to make kids ask very difficult questions of their parents and then create this kind of weird faith-based discussion on top of that. And it's hard.
I had a really hard time kind of snapping. Like, we had these very sad and tragic overtones, really. And then I had a hard time snapping into this fantastical world where angels are in the outfield. You know, like, there was, they kind of all just blended together and it didn't really work. And yeah, I like when this movie ended, I was just sad, not because it wasn't a great movie, but because it was just a really sad movie.
You know what would have made it better if we wanted to, across all the kind of ideas of this, if one of the angels had been Roger's mom. And the lesson that we got from that was her teaching him that it's okay to let go of the idea of family as he believed in it, and that family can be found right where you least expect it. And like, you know, you could have that schmaltzy line where she's the one at the end of the game with Al kind of telling him that, you know, we can't always be there. We can't always, but we find homes for people, and you can find your home right here. And, you know, have the big moment and have him and JP and George create this new family. And I think that would make it more rewarding that Roger has been able to say goodbye to his dad and that idea of family as he knew it, and really like usher in this new chapter in his life. And that would have been such a minor change. It would have given us characterization of one of the angels. Mm-hmm. It would have had a direct tie-in impact. And I think it would have like been that bit of a gut punch. Like, cause it was very clear, like, that the angels were different people. They were male, female, like they had looks. And I feel like that would have been a great way to like pull some extra tears out of you. Cause he would have, you know, been able to say goodbye to her and been like, you know, whatever part of that. But I think that would have worked better.
I think that would have been a really good change, like a really good small change. And yeah, I mean, I think the not being for kids thing kind of, I think that's true. The problem is then it just isn't really for anybody, because adults don't like it. But like, unlike Rookie of the Year, I don't feel like these, like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt does a great job. And I think JP is a really cute kid. But they're just like on the sidelines. They're not doing anything and they're not affecting anything. They don't really do, like, they are just window dressing for the adults. Whereas, like, in a movie like Rookie of the Year or in a movie like The Sandlot or Little Big League, there's like the kids are doing something. They are actively involved or they are going on adventures. There's nothing that Joseph Gordon-Levitt sees stuff happen, tells people that something is happening, but he doesn't do anything. Yeah. He doesn't affect anything. He can't control the angels. He can't even get them to do what he wants them to do. It's just, he's just a passive observer. And I think that really hurts it because you're just sort of like, I think that's where it's like, is this a kid's movie or is this just like a really dumbed down, like schmaltzy drama? Like, yeah, you know what I mean? And that's, who is it for and what is it going for?
You're right. Because for a kid's movie to work, I think what they need is an insert character. They need somebody in that movie that they can see themselves as. And I think that works really well in Rookie of the Year because Henry is just a normal kid. He's klutzy. He's bad at baseball. Mm-hmm. And something very simple happens to him in that he breaks his arm. And it's not magical abilities. It's just a weird quirk of luck. And suddenly he's got these abilities. So any kid watching that could go, well, that could be me. I could have that happen to me. And I'm bad at baseball, but one thing can change the course of your whole life. And it's the same way with Sandlot, right? Because Smalls is your main character. And it's the same idea, is that he doesn't know anything. And he still finds this ragtag group and they bring him in. And it's, you know, Benny is an idolized character. Like he's not your root core connector character. And I think you're right, is that there's these kids, but they're sidelined and no kid is going to look at this movie and be like, I want to be like the children in foster care. Like, they're not, sorry, but they're not going to look at that. And maybe if a kid in that system is watching it, then great, he can connect to that and be like, okay, but where's the realism in expecting that angels are going to come and help you find your family? Like, that's a very difficult concept for most viewers to latch on to.
Unless you have a kid that's biggest dream in life is to be a tiny terror to character actor Taylor Negron, this movie doesn't work for any children, I don't think. But if you do have a kid whose biggest dream in life is to be a small terror to Taylor Negron, wow,
we've got the flick that preview.
Wow, Disney really made a movie for that person.
Let's never tell that child that Taylor Negron is dead and kill their childlike dreams. We're going to take one more quick break. And when we get back, we'll kind of talk about our final thoughts on the movie and if we have a player that we would take for the Rays. If.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
All right. So we've just about finished talking, you know, smack about this movie. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination, it's the worst baseball movie we've watched. I don't think it's the best, obviously. I think that's pretty clear in our assessment of it. I don't think it's the worst kids baseball movie we've watched. But I do like to believe on a fundamental level that this and Air Bud Seventh Inning Fetch happen in the same cinematic universe. Because this movie ended in such a way that they had not gone to the World Series yet. And as we know from watching Air Bud, as of course, everybody who listens to our podcast went and watched Air Bud Seventh Inning Fetch after our glowing review.
Ashley, everybody's already seen it. Nobody needs to go back and watch.
No. They already have their VHS copies ready to go.
But
they fired up the laser disc. And
at the end of the movie, Air Bud is playing what, first base, I think, in for the Angels in the World Series. So I choose to believe that once they realized that the Angels weren't there to help them, win the games that they're like, well, what do we do now? And called up the small town owner of 100 different golden retrievers and said, we need your baseball dog. And that's how they won the World Series.
Why not? That's a better movie.
I mean, the logic is flawless because at the end of Angels in the Outfield, they've just won the division, I think.
Because the Angels are help. Yeah. So it's not all the way there. Well, interesting. So in this way of like bringing up Air Bud, which I feel like comes up every single time, man, Air Bud really gets a lot of play on this show. So similar to that though, Air Bud, seventh inning fetch, comes out and it ends with Air Bud, you know, going to the World Series with the Angels. The Angels go to the World Series the very next year in real life. Fun thing about Angels in the Outfield, released in 1994, the Angels, the California Angels in 92, 93, and 94 are terrible, absolutely terrible. Really one of the worst teams there. They're like 20 games under 500 most of the years. In 1995, the following year after this movie, you have the Angels actually went 78 and 67. They finished second in the AL West. So they were over 500. They actually even underperformed their Pythag by about four games. So they could have even been better. They were even better than their record showed. So an interesting thing that anytime there's an Angels movie-based movie, the real-life Angels do well. So I feel like somebody over at Disney needs to do something for poor Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani, because they need a cinematic boost to get them over the top, because it's grim over there. They need another.
Yeah.
Air Bud or Angels, maybe the crossover. They need a dead Air Bud who's now become an Angel to help them.
Oh no.
Even as a somewhat spiritual person myself, if they've got Shohei Ohtani and Mike Trout and they still can't win, I don't think any divine intervention will be able to help this ball club. I'm sorry. If they can't do it now, I don't know if it's ever going to happen again for them.
Oh, that's brutal.
But there's a good movie. The Angels come down to help and they still can't beat them. And Christopher Lloyd's like, I got nothing. This is impossible. I don't know how they do it. They still finished four games under 500, even with supernatural beings coming in and causing shenanigans.
You could be onto something, because I did write an article for Fangraphs where I said that baseball needed more kids' movies, that I think, fundamentally speaking, our generation were very much raised on these movies. Like, the best of baseball's cinematic oeuvre really did come out in the early to mid-1990s. Because that's when you had Rookie of the Year. That's when you had Sandlot. That's when you had Angels in the Outfield. You had a couple others. And we haven't had kind of like a boom in baseball movie media since then. And we really haven't had any baseball movies, period, since, what, Moneyball? Like, it's been...
Trouble with the Curve, Ashley.
I refuse to acknowledge that that movie exists.
We had Million Dollar Arm, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point.
We will,
in this podcast. Yeah. There's a couple others, but it's really, really died off.
It's slim pickings, right? So there's not a ton to choose from. And I think it's been a really long time since baseball has kind of zeroed in on kids as the main audience. And I think that that's really, and you'll notice, I think, something really interesting. Like you talked about, Darby, like this is a very focused Angels viewpoint, right? And obviously Air Bud got the permission of the Angels as well. And I think that that's really something that it kind of comes down to. These movies all had a very close tie with a real team. Like Rookie of the Year was the real Cubs. And they really filmed a bunch of those scenes in front of Cubs crowds. And I bet kids in those crowds are like, I'm in that movie, and like really feeling it to this very day. And I think that baseball really does need to like get its act in gear and say, hey, like, how can we appeal to young kids, and particularly young non-white kids, about, you know, getting them enthused and excited and seeing themselves in the game. And I think, I don't know, it's a shame that even though this movie isn't great, that we haven't gotten anything like it since 1994.
Yeah. I do think And I'm wondering if just like the streaming market and like shows and things like that have just sort of made limited target movies just to be harder to sell to yeah. things like widely, you know, like you can, the mid-range movie is like completely dead in Hollywood. It's like, if it's not like a $200 million budget or a $1 million budget, like they're not producing it. So I think that's where like a lot of the kids movies kind of fall in between. You can't do it for like a micro budget horror movie, which will make its money back easily, or a gigantic tentpole property. So,
well, it's the same way you've seen the death of the romantic comedy, like the
right.
The yeah. general, I mean, it's true, is until Netflix kind of revived it, we hadn't seen a real studio rom-com in a decade. So it's, yeah.
There could be a revival. We need a revival. But maybe with a better property than Angels in the Outfield. We can find.
No, I don't think that we should be remaking Angels in the Outfield by any stretch. But I think if we have, like, I feel like it's a great opportunity for maybe the Astros to rebuild their image. Like, let's have some sort of an Astros-themed movie.
Aliens in the Infield. They come down
out of this orbit
and they bang, you know, they use their magical trash cans from Mars to help them succeed.
No, but I feel like the Rays could really benefit from having a movie.
Randy Rosarena, there was one in the works apparently, like in the early stages of production, that, I mean, I haven't heard anything about it. I know with some of the, you know, things he was dealing yeah. with in the off season, maybe it got binned or at least stashed away in the back of a shelf somewhere, but who knows, maybe
yeah one day. And I think something like that, I think you really could have those like smaller market teams benefit from finding fandom outside of their market by putting them front and center in a movie about baseball. Like, I don't think we need to have the opener, the movie. Like, we don't need to go Moneyball with the Rays. We've done that. We've done it with the A's and it was tremendous, but you can't redo history, right? But I think you could have like a really feel good story with the Rays as the backdrop and still have that bring in new fans from the outside. Like I said, I joked when we did Fever Pitch that I almost became a Red Sox fan because of that movie, because it gives you kind of an emotional tie to a team. And I think that that's something that any team should want in an era where we're trying to find new fans across the sport. I don't know. Now I'm just off on my own hill to die on tangent because I don't want to talk about this movie anymore.
I think, yeah. So now, to the last thing we got to do before we get out of here is take a ball player from this. Now, there is baseball in this movie, but it's all pretty goofy. It's not, there's not a lot of like good baseball. It's all very much like the wire work and special effects and kind of over the top goofiness. So there's not, and the team is super inept. So before the Angels take over. So it's kind of hard to pick a player that you'd want to take because most of them were terrible before divine intervention. However, as the whole lesson of part of the movie, at least, is that they might have something in them all along if they just believed in themselves. So Ashley and Brett, which ball player or character are you taking for the real praise?
I've thought about this and I'm cheating and I'm taking Al.
Oh, and you're taking Al, the head angel.
I am taking Al.
It's a good choice.
I feel like fundamentally, the character who can most help the Rays is the one who can call forth literal divine intervention at any time except for the postseason, which may truly not help the Rays at all because they seem to do just fine making up their own ways to get to the postseason, and really is where we could use it is in the short sample size of small series. But I'm taking Al.
Okay, pretty good choice. Yeah,
I've got one that it's not really baseball related, but the Rays have currently on their roster and in the past as well some pretty good looking ball players. We've got Tyler Glass now. We've got Kevin Kiermaier, and why not add? I got to look up the character's name real quick because he was that irrelevant. Ben Williams, as portrayed by Matthew McConaughey, to this Ray's outfield.
Baby Matt McConaughey looked really good in this movie. We made a wise choice. I think he'd sell a jersey or two.
And he was playing some good defense. He's got good hustle. He's got good hustle out there. So these are good choices. I'm definitely not taking Mel Clark because ancient washed up arm. Thank you.
And terminally ill.
You don't want a pitcher who's going to die in 6 months.
Not a lot of years of control. Not a lot of years of control left.
Not that the Rays really.
You just give him whatever contract he wants. Just backload it. No. Oh yeah.
The Rays really don't care so much about contract length. I think we can safely say.
There you go. If he can really get something there. We just need a stopgap.
He can be the middle innings guy.
I'm not going to take George Knox because I think he's a terrible manager.
Yeah.
At one point he brings in somebody who was both on the IR at the time and when not warmed up into a game. So that's horrible and illegal managing. So definitely not him. I don't think Taylor Negron's character was the best publicist. So I'm not going to take him. Obviously all of our broadcast team as well as radio are phenomenal and way better than evil universe's Michael Kay. So definitely not him. Danny Hammerling, tiny, doesn't seem like he has a lot of tools. No, thank you. honestly, this is a atrocious team filled with terrible. What the catcher has some power, but he's morbidly obese. There is a certain point where it's like good body, bad body. What doesn't really matter. I'm not trying to sell jeans, but like, good Lord. Like, you know, I don't think I saw a lot of pitch framing there. I think I'm going to take of these characters, Neil McDonough's Whit Bass, who is a maybe mentally unstable person, but that works as a pitcher. And he was not very good as a starting pitcher. However, with all those quirks, that screams to me bullpen. And I feel like if any team can take a weird person and make them into something in the bullpen, it's the Rays. So give me Old Blue Eyes, Neil McDonough, Whit Bass.
He and Pete Fairbanks can have a good time being weirdos in the bullpen. Absolutely.
Weirdos with crazy eyes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Matt Whistler. They're just like crazy eye stare off. We're all three.
Oh, God. It's a solid choice. I like that you really walked us through that.
Terrible. It's a terrible choice. This is like lowest down. I would rather take in a couple more characters from Air Bud, throw in there.
Tammy every time, Air Bud.
Like, but I'll, if I'm
Tammy's forced, our catcher of the future.
Get with Bass.
Amazing. All right. Well, with that, I think we have firmly placed this one right in the middle of the pile of trash that we have watched. For this, if you have fond childhood memories of watching Angels in the Outfield, do not watch it as an adult. Not that you could if you wanted to, because truly media has swept this wildly under the rug. But if you have a library card and are ever so willing, you might get lucky like I did and get it for free.
Well, I think when people search Angels in the Outfield now on the internet and trying to watch it, the only thing that's going to come up is this podcast.
That's good. Well, we've talked you out of that decision now.
We can relive it through us.
Yeah. So you're welcome. We're sorry. Your childhood is never safe with this podcast. We do have our next episode planned, so we will not be seeking the advice of the internet, though this is one that comes up frequently when we ask for it. So in the coming weeks, you will probably hear us discuss the Kevin Costner not so classic For Love of the Game, which I believe completes his baseball trifecta of the trilogy, the unofficial Kevin Costner baseball trilogy. We have not discussed either Bull Durham or Field of Dreams. Although I feel like, guys, I hate to do it, one of these days I think we might need to talk about Field of Dreams, which anyway, I have opinions.
Next year, in honor of the next Field of Dreams game,
we did miss a golden opportunity there, but we will. So with that, we thank you for muddling through the crap with us. And always look forward to suggestions from you for next watches, because God knows there's more of these out there. So from the D-Rays Bay Podcast Network, this has been Who's On Worst. I'm your host, Ashley. Darby Robinson, Brett Rutherford, we send you thanks and good viewing.